I'm very, very pleased to be here this morning. I was told that the program called for a long speech and no questions. I'm going to turn that around and have a short speech with long questions, and so we can have a discussion rather than a speech. When I came into the hall this morning, I was met by seven or eight people in wheelchairs holding up signs, telling us something that we've not been aware of as we should, and trying to tell all of us who've been lucky enough not to be physically handicapped to take a harder look at what it's like to live as an American if you are. And that's something that we should think about, not just think about, but act on. And I promised them that I'd talk about it right up front because I want to, and I think we all want to correct that enormous wrong. There are different kinds of discrimination in America, but I don't know of any that can be less justified and more outrageous than to ask Americans who are handicapped to be a part of only a portion of American life. I've served for some years on the subcommittee of the handicap of the United States Senate, where we've tried at long last to do something about it. We began by looking at our own nation's capital, paid for by the American people, belonging to them, and we were horrified to see that there were no ramps for the handicapped, no water fountains, no special ways of getting around, no telephones, no restrooms. We were literally saying to the several million handicapped of America, don't come to your own capital. And I think that every American should listen to that cause and correct it now. This university and all institutions around this country ought to make their facilities, their educational institutions, and everything else fully available to the handicapped of this country. That's the least we can do for them, and I hope we'll do it. Now, Bob Carr isn't here today. He's in the Congress. But you will recall, some of you, that I came here and campaigned with Bob Carr in 1974. I'm told Bob won by how many votes?
74.
74 votes. And I think I carried the election for him by coming here to Michigan State. And I'm very proud of Bob. I know you are. And I know you're going to give him your support for re-election. You know, I've been in the Senate now for 12 years. And I can tell you, if there's one person that we would all agree deserves the description of the saint of the Senate, it's Phil Hart of the state of Michigan. A marvelous, decent, thoughtful, concerned, courageous man. Who has always listened much more closely to his conscience than he has read the public opinion polls. And that kind of person is rare in American public life and essential to the survival and the health of American society. And this year, as you know, he's retiring and he's in very poor health. And it's an indication of Senator Hart's greatness that for the first time in the nearly 200 years history of the Congress, a building was named after a living senator, because all of us wanted Phil Hart to know, but more than that, all of us wanted the nation to know what we thought of this extraordinarily gifted, humane, and decent person. And every citizen of Michigan ought to be proud of what you've given to this country by sending him to the United States Senate. And one of the reasons I'm so pleased to be supporting Don Riegel for the United States Senate is I think we have another person coming along in Don Riegel with the capacity to be a Phil Hart kind of senator. Courageous, strong, the kind of person that represents this special spirit of Michigan that we've come to expect over the years. I'd like to make just a few comments, and then let's go to the questions. We've been trying to campaign all over this country with the people. We've not been trying to protect ourselves. We've not been trying to hide behind desks. We've tried to be where people are and to listen to the people, whether it's hiring halls or staying overnight in a college dormitory. And that's the last time I'm going to do that. I found out about dormitories. Number one, most of them are coeducational, but my ethics officer made me stay in one of the others. Secondly, unlike our days, you have refrigerators. And the one I had a nice refrigerator full of lemonade. Schlitz lemonade. And we have been all over the country, and we're going to continue to do just that. Meanwhile, our opposition, Republican president, has been hiding behind his desk in Washington. Yesterday, I picked up, anytime you want to applaud, let it rip. And yesterday, I picked up a newspaper that sort of tells the whole story. Here's a picture of Jimmy Carter greeting people on the streets of St. Louis. And next to it, this story. Ford poses with cow during quiet weekend. Well, I grew up in a dairy area. You won't believe that, but I used to talk to cows when I was a kid. Some of them are quite handsome, but I never met one that was very bright. In this campaign, we are not only being with the people, but we're trying to talk for the concerns of Americans as we see them and we hear them, so that we'll be qualified to represent you when you elect us. I think the opposition is showing that they're out of touch with what Americans want. And I'm going to use as my text the speech that the Republican president gave last week at another institution in Michigan, the name of which I now forget. Because he gave this speech in which he said, the following are the key issues in America. One, a job for everyone with a good future. Home ownership for all. Quality education for every American. Good health care for all that's affordable. Safety against crime. And a national and improved system of parks. I believe that the president has a spy on his staff that slipped him the wrong list, because that's a list of his failures, not his successes. You know, the other week he went out to Yellowstone National Park and, with Old Faithful as a backdrop, gave a speech about the need for more national parks, which mystified me some, and I checked his record. The only park he supported in the last 8 years is the president of South Korea. That's the only one. So let's just briefly tick off those issues and see what their record really is. Let's take employment. Since this Republican president was sworn in, 2.5 million Americans have been added to the unemployment rolls. For every 10 Americans standing in the unemployment rolls lines when he became president, there are now 15. In the city of Lansing, 11% of the citizens are unemployed. And in the state of Michigan, if you count the discouraged workers, over 10%. Are unemployed. Every 10th citizen of this state looking for a job. We now have the highest unemployment outside of the Great Depression. And I don't know how an administration
that has so colossally failed in the field of employment can now turn around and claim that they have a policy to undo everything they've done. Let's look at education. They said we need quality education for every American. But what does their budget say? Where are they going in terms of federal resources to assist the educational institutions such as the one we're at here today? Well, today, the Ford budget proposes a 24% cut in federal scholarships and other support for higher education, including vocational education. He proposes a 25% cut in student assistance across the board, nearly a $500 million cut in assistance for federal aid to educational institutions at the higher and the post-secondary educational level. That plus inflation makes it one of the most disastrous proposals to withdraw federal support for the educational systems of our country that we've ever seen. And how a person with that kind of record can turn around and come to an institution of higher education and seek to persuade them that he's for good educational programs is more than I can understand. He said that there should be home ownership for all Americans. But there isn't a recession, there's a depression in housing. The building trades unemployment, I would bet, in Michigan is 25 or 30%. Because of this, high interest rates, no housing production, the cost of housing has doubled in this country in 6 years. And now on the eve of the election, the president would have us believe that he's been for housing all along. Same with health care. Health care has risen by 25% in urban areas, and the president's budget this year proposed $1.5 billion shift away from the treasury onto the backs of senior citizens for the cost of Medicare and Medicaid. And further, the president said, if we sent him a national health insurance bill, he would veto it. So here you have a series of issues listed by them: jobs, housing, health, education, parks and recreation, where what they now claim they are for is belied by their record, their budgets, over the many years that they've been in public life. And people who are educated, people who are concerned, must look carefully at those statements today, because they are election year campaigning that have nothing to do with the record of that administration or of those leaders. Next, they say they're dealing with inflation, but yesterday's consumer price index shows that they have not, that the cost of living continues to soar far above their rosy predictions, and it's not hard to realize why. First of all, their high interest policies are reflected in the cost of everything we buy. Secondly, and this is very important, they have no antitrust policy to break up these large industries, to restrain them from antitrust activities that permit these industries in the so-called administered price fields to charge ever-rising prices even in the face of a recession. This economy cannot work. It will never work without competition. I am not a socialist. I believe in competition. But the very people that carry that free enterprise flag around this country are usually the first ones to try to paralyze antitrust enforcement in this country. Phil Hart has led the fight all during these administrations to get strong antitrust legislation passed. And this administration has fought it every step of the way. And we need a president with guts enough to support strong antitrust legislation, pass it, and then enforce it, so that American business, particularly in the large sectors, has to compete once again for the support of the consumer of America. If you'll do that, let me just give a couple examples and I'm going to quit. The aluminum industry just raised this past year their prices by 11%, even though 25% of their capacity is idled. There is a private report prepared by the Council of Wage and Price Stability that we are told has studied this and declared it to be price gouging. There's no excuse for those price increases. What did this administration do? They tried to suppress the report. They did nothing to try to get the aluminum industry to restrain their pricing. The other day there was a report that the American oil industry overcharged the American consumers $1.3 billion over what the Federal Energy Administration permitted them to charge under their own guidelines. That money should have been returned to the American consumer. It would help fight inflation. $1 billion is an awful lot of money. Instead of that, the administration said, oh no, we'll change the guidelines. Now, we're never going to lick inflation with high interest rates, with no competition, with tax policies which increase the taxes on the average American while letting the very wealthy structure their income in a way that they pay little or nothing in taxes. And so in all of these areas, jobs, housing, health, inflation, I think they've performed miserably. And then one final point. In the field of dealing with the poor, in my early public career, I worked with people like Bobby Kennedy and others to try to focus this nation's attention on the millions of people in American life who are in this country, but in no sense a part of the fullness of American life. Not enough to eat, poor schools, squalid housing in neighborhoods, depressing and dispiriting environments. And these people, particularly the children, often just shrivel like a prune and are unable to achieve an American life. And it seems to me that there's a special dimension to American life that has disappeared in recent years. It is no longer fashionable to talk about justice for the poor and the disadvantaged, to talk about the elimination of discrimination where it still exists. In addition to dealing with these problems that affect most of us, I think this nation will only be true to its values if we also restore, as a central concern in American life, a concern and programs coupled with that concern to deal with the poor and the disadvantaged in our society. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Now, if we have questions, we'll take them. And I've been asked to repeat the question, if you don't mind, because I guess we have a couple of other rooms filled with students. Go ahead. Well, now, the question, the legalization of hard drugs, was that your question? Well, it's my understanding that hard drugs, that the issue has really been marijuana and not hard drugs. I don't know of anybody proposing the legalization of hard drugs. My personal opinion is that people who push hard drugs are among the worst in American society. The laws prohibiting it ought to be very stiff. And one of my complaints today is that the whole Drug Enforcement Act is in shambles. As a matter of fact, the present president, it didn't even have a director of the agency for some months. And I would be very tough on pushers in that whole ring that brings in imports and the rest hard drugs. And I think very little mercy is. Anybody try to make a living out of hooking somebody on hard drugs, I think deserves very little sympathy.
I agree with you there, but my question really circles around the fact that these organized crime officials infiltrate the court system many times, and I just believe that what
Well, you're talking, Al, I get you. Oh, I get you. You're talking about the British experiment where they've legalized the use of hard drugs and the theory that the... Well, I'm not familiar with that. But I've done some reading on the British system, and I don't think it's been as successful as I originally thought it would be. Now, I just finished 18 months as the chairman of the Democrat domestic task force of the Church Committee investigating the CIA, the FBI, and the rest. And I came away with the distinct impression that neither in the field of drugs nor in the field of organized crime are we anywhere near mounting the kind of attack that's needed. I think organized crime is a much bigger problem than many people realize, and I don't think we're doing nearly enough about it. You know, Mr. Hoover, the director of the FBI, never wanted to get involved in either drug pushers, drug peddling, or organized crime. And that's one of the reasons we have a separate department dealing with drug abuse, and why there's a separate sort of what they call a strike force that is supposed to strike at organized crime, but on which, at least up to a few months ago, the FBI was not even represented. He didn't want to be on the strike forces. And I would hope that one of the things that we will do, and I'm certainly going to push very hard for this, with our administration, is to take very, very seriously enforcement problems in the field of hard drugs and in the field of organized crime, because I think it does seep into many, many aspects of American life, undermine and corrupt our institutions, and totally destroy public faith in the public process every time they see examples of it. Thank you very much.
Good.
The question is our policy on Latin America. I think that the most consistent indictment that can responsibly be made against the foreign policy the last 8 years has been the lack of any relationship in so many instances between our foreign policy and our own values. We are a country that honors democracy, practices democracy, speaks the language of international stability, of rationality, and the rest. But instead, Chile's a good example, we pursued a policy of covert subversion to subvert and overthrow the elected president of Chile. I don't happen to think he was a very good president, but I also know that I wasn't a citizen of Chile, and it was none of my business. Instead of that, we went in there through covert activities and, among other things, assisted in the abduction of General Snyder, the head of the joint their armed forces. General Snyder was killed as a result. We didn't intend to do it, but we participated in the abduction that led to his killing. And then, of course, Allende was overthrown, and the result now is an oppressive, military, cruel dictatorship in one of the major countries of Latin America, and unfortunately, but with some degree of credibility, we're being blamed for leading to that result. And as you know, we've done entirely too much work in cooperation with some of the other dictatorships in Latin America, and I don't think we can always have our way in the world. But I don't know why we did that in Chile, why we've done some of the other things we've done, why we were so close to the Greek junta and now turn our back on the Greek democracy, why we tilted to Pakistan against the Bangladesh, who are doing just what we were doing, seeking their own independence. All the way through this, we see this reluctance to act overseas in a way that expresses our own values here at home. And one of the things we've got to do is simply to return to our own values and have an open foreign policy, not a closed one that we have today, and one that makes it clear where we stand and act in that way.
Give me some water, I'm dying.
Senator Lawndale, what is the Democratic program for dealing with the simultaneous appearance of inflation and recession? How is that program different from that of the Republican Party?
The question was, how do we propose to deal with the simultaneous phenomenon of inflation and recession? Well, first of all, let me say that it's been one of the outstanding characteristics of this administration that they've been able to get us both. It hasn't happened too often in American history, but they've done it, and they've done it consistently. They've got what they call the discomfort index, you know, that measures inflation and unemployment. And these last 8 years of Republican economics have marked the highest discomfort index outside of the Great Depression. And they've done it, in my opinion, for several reasons. First of all, they have always misanalyzed the problem. These last two or three years, we have not been suffering excess demand. We've not had too many dollars chasing too few goods. But they pursued an economic policy that assumes that's the source of inflation. So they've tightened up on credit. They've increased interest to highest levels. They've kept their foot on the fiscal pedal, or on the brake. And the result is they have greatly slowed down the economy. And that's why we have such high unemployment, so many business failures, because they have deliberately restrained the economy. But it hasn't solved inflation, because that isn't the source of the inflation. Inflation has been based on cost push factors that permit prices to rise even in the face of recession. Energy prices are an example. And for example, if Ford had had his way, energy would cost about 40 or 50% more than it costs right now. As a matter of fact, the average family would be paying $500 more this year for the cost of energy than they do now if he'd gotten away with his policies. It shows up in these administered price fields that I've talked about. If you want to stop inflation, you've got to make these industries compete again so that that supply and demand principle comes back into place. So what we've got is the worst of both worlds. We applied, it's sort of like coming in with a broken leg and being cured for, given a cancer cure. It doesn't help the leg, and it may make you worse in other ways. It just hasn't worked. Now, in our opinion, more stimulation is clearly indicated. We're far short of the point where we're pressing the, where demand is pressing on capacity to produce, both in terms of manpower and industrial productivity. Once we arrive at that point where demand might be stimulating inflation again, then we think a more vigorous incomes policy is indicated. Not wage and price controls, but jawboning with teeth, at least. And then we think there's some microeconomic tools we can use to improve the employment pictures by targeting programs, say, into areas of high unemployment, through economic development programs, through manpower programs, public service employment programs, and the rest. But there are ways, through a combination of civilized and rational macro and microeconomic policies, to come much closer to full employment, and to do so without the massive economic and personal costs that this present policy has now imposed upon this country. And in the state of Michigan, you see exactly what we're talking about. I'll just put it frankly, there is utterly no hope that these Republicans will ever pursue a civilized economic policy. They never have. Mr. Hoover, Mr. Eisenhower, Mr. Nixon, Mr. Ford stink on economic policy. Thank you, but I gotta go back. Thank you very much. I'd love to take a lot more questions, but I'm going to end with one question from a handicapped representative. Can we get a microphone there, or would someone repeat the question? I'll do it. Now, that question, I think there was one stated question and one unstated question. The stated question, would I sign a commitment for the handicap? I will be glad to do it, and I want you to look at my record, because you'll know that I've already been where I said I am. The second thing is, the question suggests that public leaders cannot be trusted, and therefore the only way you can shackle them into their campaign promises is to make them put it in writing. Two things about that. If it's a false promise, not even writing helps. And if there's one thing I'd like to be a part of in this country, is to remove this justified mistrust about public officers that has led so many Americans to believe they can't be believed. You've had enough to feed that feeling of distrust and cynicism. I'd like to be a part of just a simple change of obeying the law and telling the truth and doing what we said. I think that'd do more for this country than anything else.